subsequent smiles, and went back to her queries, hoping that Nancy was satisfied and happy and that they were cool. She took 3 more queries, she followed up with surveys, and saw that her average was at 99. This provoked a flurry of congratulatory zings, watchers happy to see May's commitment, still, to the day-to-day tasks at the Circle, and essential to the operation of the world. So many of her watchers, they reminded her, were working at desk jobs too, and because she continued to do this work, voluntarily and with evident joy, they saw her as a role model and inspiration. And this felt good. This felt truly valuable to May. The customers made her better, and serving them while transparent made her far better. She expected this. She was apprised by Stuart that when thousands or even millions are watching, you perform your best self. You are cheerier, more positive, more polite, more generous, more inquisitive. But he had not told her of the smaller, improving alterations to her behavior. The first time the camera redirected her actions was when she went to the kitchen for something to eat. The image on her wrist showed the interior of the refrigerator as she scanned for a snack. Normally, she would have grabbed a chilled brownie, but seeing the image of her hand reaching for it, and seeing what everyone else would be seeing, she pulled back. She closed the fridge, and from the bowl on the counter, she selected a packet of almonds and left the kitchen. Later that day, a headache appeared, caused, she thought, by eating less chocolate than usual. She reached into her bag, where she kept a few single-serving aspirin packets, but again, on her screen, she saw what everyone was seeing. She saw a hand searching her bag, clawing, and instantly she felt desperate and wretched, like some kind of pill-popping addict. She did without. Every day she'd done without things she didn't want to want, things she didn't need. She'd given up soda, energy drinks, processed foods. At Circle social events, she nursed one drink only and tried each time to leave it unfinished. Anything immoderate would provoke a flurry of zings of concern, so she stayed within the bounds of moderation, and she found it freeing. She was liberated from bad behavior. She was liberated from doing things she didn't want to be doing, eating and drinking things that did her no good. Since she'd gone transparent, she'd become more noble. People called her a role model. Mothers said their daughters looked up to her, and this gave her more a feeling of responsibility, and that feeling of responsibility to the Circlers, to their clients and partners, to the youth who saw inspiration in her, kept her grounded and fueled her days. She was reminded of the Circle's own survey questions, and she put on her survey headset and got started. To her watchers, she was expressing her opinions constantly, yes, and felt far more influential than before. But something about the tidy rhythm and call-and-response nature of the surveys felt missing. She took another customer query and then nodded. The distant bell rang. She nodded.
"Thank you. Are you happy with the state of airport security?"
"Smile," May said.
"Thank you. Would you welcome change in airport security procedures?"
"Yes."
"Thank you. Does the state of airport security dissuade you from flying more often?"
"Yes."
"Thank you."
The questions continued, and she was able to get through 94 of them before she allowed herself to lapse. Soon the voice arrived, unchanged. "May?" She ignored it on purpose. "May?" Her name, spoken by her voice, continued to hold its power over her, and she hadn't discovered why. "May?" It sounded, this time, like some purer version of herself. "May?" She looked down to her bracelet, seeing a number of zings, asking if she was okay. She knew she had to respond, lest her watchers think she'd lost her mind. This was one of the many small adjustments she had to get used to. Now there were thousands out there seeing what she saw, having access to her health data, hearing her voice, seeing her face. She was always visible through one or another of the campus sea change cameras, in addition to the one on her monitor. And so, when anything deviated from her normal buoyancy, people noticed. "May?" She wanted to hear it again, so she said nothing. "May?" It was a young woman's voice, a young woman's voice that sounded bright and fierce and capable of anything. "May?" It was a better, more indomitable version of herself.
May. She felt stronger every time she heard it. She stayed at CE until 5, when she showed her watch as the newest clarification, the governor of Arizona, and enjoyed the surprise transparency of the governor's entire staff, something that many officials were doing to ensure to their constituents that deals were not being done, in darkness, outside the light of the clear leader. At the clarifying event, May met up with Renata and Denise and Josiah, these circlers who had once wielded some power over her and now were her acolytes. And afterward, they all had dinner in the glass eatery. There was little reason to leave campus for meals, given that Bailey, hoping to engender more discussions and brain-sharing and socialization among circlers, had instituted a new policy whereby all food would be not only free, as it always had been, but prepared daily by a different notable chef. The chefs were happy for the exposure, thousands of circlers smiling, zinging, posting photos, and the program was instantly and wildly popular, and the cafeterias were overflowing with people and, presumably, ideas. Among the bustle that night, May ate, feeling unsteady, Calden's words and cryptic messages still rattling in her head. She was glad, then, for the distractions of the night. The improv comedy battle was appropriately terrible and funny, despite its wall-to-wall incompetence. The Pakistan fundraiser was thoroughly inspiring. The event was able to amass 2.3 million smiles for the school. And finally, there was the barbecue, where May allowed herself a second glass of wine before settling into her dorm. The room had been hers for 6 weeks now. It no longer made sense to drive back to her apartment, which was expensive and, last time she'd been there, after being gone for 8 days, had mice. So she gave it up and became one of the 100 settlers, circlers who had moved onto campus permanently. The advantages were obvious, and the waiting list was now 1,209 names long. There was room on campus now for 288 circlers, and the company had just bought a nearby building, a former factory, planning to convert it into 500 more rooms. May's had been upgraded and now had fully smart appliances, wall screens and shades, everything centrally monitored. The room was cleaned daily and the refrigerator stocked with both her standard items, tracked via Homey, and products in beta. She could have anything she wanted, so long as she provided feedback to the manufacturers. She washed her face and brushed her teeth and settled into the cloud-white bed. Transparency was optional after 10 p.m., and she usually went dark after her teeth brushing, which she found people interested in generally, and, she believed, might promote good dental health among her younger watchers. At 10:11 p.m., she said goodnight to her watchers. There were only 98,027 at that point, a few thousand of whom reciprocated her goodnight wishes, lifted her lens over her head, and placed it in its case. She was allowed to turn off the sea-change cameras in the room, but she found she rarely did. She knew that the footage she might gather, herself, for instance, about movements during sleep, could be valuable someday, so she left the cameras on. It had taken a few weeks to get used to sleeping with her wrist monitors. She'd scratched her face one night and cracked her right screen another. But Circle engineers had improved the design, replacing the rigid screens with more flexible, unbreakable ones, and now she felt incomplete without them. She sat up in bed, knowing that it usually took her an hour or so to make her way to sleep. She turned on the wall screen, planning to check on her parents, but their sea-change cameras were all dark. She sent them a zing, expecting no answer and getting none. She sent a message to Annie, but got no response. She paged through her zing feed, reading a few funny ones, and because she'd lost 6 pounds since going transparent, she spent 20 minutes looking for a new skirt and T-shirt, and somewhere in the 8th site she visited, she felt the tear opening up in her again. For no good reason, she checked to see if Mercer's site was still down, and found it was. She looked for any recent mention of him online or news of his whereabouts, and found none. The tear was growing within her, opening quickly, a fathomless blackness spreading under her. In her fridge, she had some of the sake Francis had introduced her to, so she got up, poured herself far too much, and drank it down. She went to the sea-change portal and watched feeds from beaches in Sri Lanka and Brazil, feeling calmer, feeling warmer, and then remembered that a few thousand college kids calling themselves change-seers had spread themselves all over the planet, installing cameras in the most remote regions. So for a time she watched the view from a camera in a Namibian desert village, a pair of women preparing a meal, their children playing in the background. But after a few minutes watching, she found the tear opening wider, the underwater screams getting louder, an unbearable hiss. She looked again for Calden, spelling his name in new and irrational ways, scanning, for 45 minutes, the company directory by face, finding no one like him at all. She turned off the sea-change cameras, poured more sake, drank it down, and got into bed. And thinking of Calden and his hands, his thin legs, his long fingers, she circled her nipples with her left hand, while, with her right, she moved her underwear to the side and simulated the movements of a tongue, of his tongue. It had no effect, but the sake was draining her mind of worry, and finally, at just before 12, she found something like sleep.
"Okay, everyone,"
May said. The morning was bright, and she was feeling chipper enough to try out a phrase she hoped might catch on circle-wide or beyond.
"This is a day like every other day, in that it is unlike any other day."
After she said it, May checked her wrist, but saw little sign it had struck a nerve. She was momentarily deflated, but the day itself, the unlimited promise it offered, buoyed her. It was 9:34 a.m. The sun was again bright and warm, and the campus was busy and abuzz. If the circlers needed any confirmation that they were in the middle of everything that mattered, the day had already brought it. Starting at 8:31, a series of helicopters had shaken the campus, bringing leaders from all the major health insurance companies, world health agencies, the Centers for Disease Control, and every significant pharmaceutical company. Finally, it was rumored, there would be complete information sharing among all these previously disconnected and even adversarial entities, and when they were coordinated, and once all the health data they'd collected was shared, most of this made possible through the circle, and more importantly, through you. Viruses could be stopped at their sources, diseases would be tracked to their roots. All morning, May had watched these executives and doctors and officials stride happily through the grounds, heading for the just-built hippocampus. There, they'd have a day of meetings, private this time, with public forums promised in the future. And later, there would be a concert from some aging singer-songwriter only Bailey cared for, who had come in the night before for dinner with the wise men. Most important for May, though, was that one of the many morning helicopters contained Annie, who was finally coming home. She'd been gone for almost a month in Europe and China and Japan, ironing out some regulatory wrinkles, meeting with some of the transparent leaders there, the results of which seemed good, judging from the number of smiles Annie had posted on her Zing feed at the trip's conclusion. But more meaningful conversation between May and Annie had been difficult. Annie had congratulated her on her transparency, on her ascension, as Annie put it, but then had become very busy. Too busy to write notes of consequence, too busy to have phone calls she could be proud of, she'd said. They'd exchanged brief messages every day, but Annie's schedule had been, in her words, madcap, and the time difference meant they were rarely in sync and able to exchange anything profound. Annie had promised to arrive in the morning, direct from Beijing, and May was having trouble concentrating while waiting. She'd been watching the helicopters land, squinting high on the rooftops, looking for Annie's yellow head, to no avail. And now she had to spend an hour at the Protagorean Pavilion, a task she knew was important and normally would find fascinating, but today felt like an unbreachable wall between herself and her closest friend. On a granite panel outside the Protagorean Pavilion, the building's namesake was quoted loosely. "Humans are the measure of all things." "More important for our purposes," May said, opening the door, "is that now, with the tools available, humans can measure all things. Isn't that right, Terry?" In front of her stood a tall Korean-American man, Terry Min.
"Hello, May. Hello, May's watchers and followers."
"You cut your hair some new way," May said.
With Annie coming back, May was feeling loopy, goofy, and Terry was temporarily derailed. He hadn't counted on ad-libs.
Yeah, he said, running his fingers through it.
"It's angular," May said.
"Right, it is more angular. Should we go inside?"
"We should."
The designers of the building had taken pains to use organic shapes to soften the rigid math of the engineer's daily work. The atrium was encased in silver and seemed to undulate as if they stood at the bottom of an enormous corrugated tube.
"What will we be seeing today, Terry?"
"I thought we'd start with a tour and then go a bit deeper with some stuff we're doing for the educational sector."
May followed Terry through the building, which was more of an engineer's lair than the parts of campus she'd become accustomed to visiting. The trick with her audience was to balance the mundane with the more glamorous parts of the circle. Both were necessary to reveal, and certainly thousands of viewers were more interested in the boiler rooms than the penthouses. But the calibration had to be precise. They passed Joseph and his teeth, and then said hello to various developers and engineers, each of whom turned to explain their work as best they could. May checked the time and saw there was a new notice from Dr. Villalobos. She asked May to come visit as soon as she could. "Nothing urgent," she said, "but it should be today." As they made their way through the building, May typed back to the doctor, saying she'd see her in 30 minutes.
"Should we see the education project now?"
"I think that's a great idea," Terry said. They walked through a curving hallway and into a great open space, with at least 100 circlers working without division. It looked a bit like a mid-century stock market.
"As your viewers might know," Terry said, "the Department of Education has given us a nice grant. Wasn't it $3 billion?
May asked.
"Well, who's counting?" Terry said, abundantly satisfied with the number and what it demonstrated, which was that Washington knew the circle could measure anything, including student achievement, better than they ever hoped to.
"But the point is that they asked us to design and implement a more effective wraparound data assessment system for the nation's students."
"Oh, wait, this is cool," Terry said.
They stopped in front of a woman and a small child. He looked about 3 and was playing with a very shiny silver watch attached to his wrist.
"Hi, Marie," Terry said to the woman. "This is May, as you probably know."
"I do know May,"
Marie said in the slightest French accent.
"And Michel here does too. Say hello, Michel."
Michel chose to wave.
"Say something to Michel, May,"
Terry said.
"How are you, Michel?" May said.
"Okay, now show her,"
Terry said, nudging Michel's shoulder. On its tiny display, the watch on Michel's wrist had registered the 4 words May had just said. Below these numbers was a counter, with the number 29,266 displayed.
"Studies show that kids need to hear at least 30,000 words a day,"
Marie explained.
"So the watch does a very simple thing by recognizing, categorizing, and most crucially, counting those words. This is primarily for kids at home and before school age. Once they're there, we're assuming all this is tracked in the classroom."
"That's a good segue," Terry said.
They thanked Marie and Michel and made their way down the hall to a large room decorated like a classroom, but rebooted, with dozens of screens, ergonomic chairs, collaborative workspaces.
"Oh, here's Jackie," Terry said.
Jackie, a sleek woman in her mid-30s, emerged and shook May's hand. She was wearing a sleeveless dress, highlighting her broad shoulders and mannequin arms. She had a small cast on her right wrist.
"Hi, May. I'm so glad you could visit today."
Her voice was polished, professional, but with something flirtatious in it. She stood in front of the camera, her hands clasped before her.
"So, Jackie," Terry said, clearly enjoying being near her, "can you tell us a bit about what you're doing here?"
May saw an alert on her wrist and interrupted.
"Maybe first tell us where you came from before heading up this project. That's an interesting story."
"Well, thank you for saying that, May. I don't know how interesting it is, but before joining the circle, I was in private equity, and before that I was part of a group that started You Were a Swimmer,"
May prompted.
"You were in the Olympics."
"Oh, that," Jackie said, throwing a hand in front of her smiling mouth.
"You won a bronze medal in 2000?
"I did."
Jackie's sudden shyness was endearing. May checked to confirm and saw the accumulation of a few thousand smiles.
"And you had said internally that your experience as a world-class swimmer informed your plan here?"
"Yes, it did, May,"
Jackie said, now seeming to grasp where May was going with the dialogue.
"There are so many things we could talk about here in the Protagorean Pavilion, but one interesting one for your viewers is what we're calling youth rank. Come over here for a second. Let's look at the big board."
She led May over to a wall screen, about 20 feet square.
"We've been testing a system in Iowa for the last few months, and now that you're here, it seems a good time to demonstrate it. Maybe one of your viewers, if they're currently in high school in Iowa, would like to send you their name and school?"
You heard the woman, May said. Anyone out there watching from Iowa and currently in high school?
May checked her wrist, where 11 zings came through. She showed them to Jackie, who nodded.
Okay, May said. So you just need her name?
Name and school, Jackie said.
May read one of the zings.
I have here Jennifer Batsuri, who says she attends Achievement Academy in Cedar Rapids.
Okay, Jackie said, turning back to the wall screen.
Let's bring up Jennifer Batsuri from Achievement Academy.
The name appeared on the screen, with a school photo accompanying it. The photo revealed her to be an Indian-American girl of about 16, with braces and wearing a green and tan uniform. Beside her photo, two numerical counters were spinning, the numbers rising until they slowed and stopped, the upper figure at 1,396, the one below it at 179,827.
Well, well, congratulations, Jennifer, Jackie said, her eyes to the screen.
She turned to May.
It seems we have a real achiever here from Achievement Academy. She's ranked 1,396 out of 179,827 high school students in Iowa.
May checked the time. She needed to speed Jackie's demonstration up.
And this is calculated. Jennifer's score is the result of comparing her test results, her class rank, her school's relative academic strength, and a number of other factors.
How's that look to you, Jennifer?
May asked. She checked her wrist, but Jennifer's feed was silent. There was a brief, awkward moment where May and Jackie expected Jennifer to return, expressing her joy, but she did not come back. May knew it was time to move on.
And can this be compared against all the other students in the country, and maybe even the world?
She asked.
That's the idea, Jackie said. Just as within the circle we know our participation rank, for example, soon we'll be able to know at any given moment where our sons or daughters stand against the rest of American students, and then against the world students.
That sounds very helpful, May said, and would eliminate a lot of the doubt and stress out there.
Well, think of what this would do for a parent's understanding of their child's chances for college admission. There are about 12,000 spots for Ivy League freshmen every year. If your child is in the top 12,000 nationally, then you can imagine they'd have a good chance at one of those spots.
And it'll be updated how often?
Oh, daily. Once we get full participation from all schools and districts, we'll be able to keep daily rankings with every test, every pop quiz incorporated instantly. And, of course, these can be broken up between public and private, regional, and the rankings can be merged, weighted, and analyzed to see trends among various other factors, socioeconomic, race, ethnicity, everything.
A.G. dinged in May's ear.
Ask about how it intersects with True Youth.
Jackie, I understand this overlaps in an interesting way with True Youth, formerly known as Child Track.
May got the sentence out just before a wave of nausea and sweat overtook her. She didn't want to see Francis. Maybe it wouldn't be Francis. There were other circlers on the project. She checked her wrist, thinking she might be able to quickly find him with circle search, but then there he was, striding toward her.
"Here's Francis Garaventa,"
Jackie said, oblivious to May's distress.
"Who can talk about the intersection between youth rank and True Youth, which I must say is at once revolutionary and necessary."
As Francis walked toward them, his hands coyly behind his back, May and Jackie both watched him, May feeling sweat pool in her armpits and also sensing that Jackie had a more than professional feeling for him. This was a different Francis. He was still shy, still slight, but his smile was confident, as if he'd been recently praised and expected more.
"Hi, Francis,"
Jackie said, shaking his hand with her unbroken one and turning her shoulder flirtatiously. It was not apparent to the camera or to Francis, but to May it was as subtle as a gong.
"Hello, Jackie. Hello, May," he said. "Can I bring you into my lair?"
He smiled and, without waiting for a response, turned and led them into the next room. May hadn't seen his office and felt conflicted about sharing it with her watchers. It was a dark room with dozens of screens arranged on the wall into a seamless grid.
"So, as your watchers might know, we've been pioneering a program to make kids safer.
In the states where we've been testing the program, there's been an almost 90% drop in all crime and a 100% drop in child abductions. Nationwide, we've had only 3 abductions total, and all were rectified within minutes, given our ability to track the location of the participating children.
It's been just incredible, Jackie said, shaking her head, her voice low and soaked in something like lust.
Frances smiled at her, oblivious or pretending to be. May's wrist was alive with thousands of smiles and hundreds of comments. Parents in states without youth track were considering moving. Frances was being compared to Moses.
And meanwhile, Jackie said, the crew here at the Protagorean Pavilion has been working to coordinate all student measurements to make sure that all homework, reading, attendance, and test scores are all kept in one unified database. They're almost there. We're inches away from the moment when, by the time a student is ready for college, we have complete knowledge of everything that student has learned. Every word they read, every word they looked up, every sentence they highlighted, every equation they wrote, every answer and correction. The guesswork of knowing where all students stand and what they know will be over.
May's wrist was still scrolling madly. Where was this 20 years ago? A watcher wrote. My kids would have gone to Yale.
Now Frances stepped in. The idea that he and Jackie had been rehearsing this made May ill.
Now the exciting and blazingly simple part, he said, smiling at Jackie with professional respect, is that we can store all this information in the nearly microscopic chip, which is now used purely for safety reasons. But what if it provides both locational tracking and educational tracking? What if it's all in one place?
It's a no-brainer, Jackie said.
Well, I hope parents will see it that way. For participating families, they'll have constant and real-time access to everything. Location, scores, attendance, everything. And it won't be in some handheld device, which the kid might lose. It'll be in the cloud, and in the child, him or herself, never to be lost.
Perfection, Jackie said.
Well, I hope so, Frances said, looking at his shoes, hiding in what May knew to be a fog of false modesty. And as you all know, he said, turning to May, speaking to her watchers, we here at the Circle have been talking about completion a lot, and though even us Circlers don't know yet just what completion means, I have a feeling it's something like this. Connecting services and programs that are just inches apart. We track kids for safety, we track kids for educational data. Now we're just connecting these two threads, and when we do, we can finally know the whole child. It's simple. And dare I say, it's complete.
May was standing outside, in the center of the western part of campus, knowing she was stalling until Annie returned. It was 1:44, far later than she thought it would be before her arrival, and now she worried about missing her. May had an appointment with Dr. Villalobos at 2 o'clock, and that might take a while, given the doctor had warned her that there was something relatively serious, but not health serious, she'd made clear, to talk about. But crowding out thoughts of Annie and the doctor was Frances, who was suddenly, bizarrely, attractive to her again.
May knew the easy trick that had been played upon her. He was thin and without any muscle tone, his eyes were weak, and he had a pronounced problem with premature ejaculation. Yet, simply because she'd seen the lust in Jackie's eyes, May found herself wanting to be alone with him again. She wanted to bring him into her room that night. The thought was demented. She needed to clear her mind. It seemed like an appropriate time to explain and reveal the new sculpture.
Okay, we have to see this, May said. This was done by a renowned Chinese artist who's been in frequent trouble with the authorities there. At that moment, though, May couldn't remember the artist's name. While we're on the subject, I want to thank all the watchers who sent frowns to the government there, both for their persecution of this artist and for their restrictions on internet freedoms. We sent over 180 million frowns from the U.S. alone, and you can bet that this has an effect on the regime.
May still couldn't retrieve the artist's name and felt the omission was about to be noticed. Then it came through her wrist, say the man's name, and they provided it. She directed her lens toward the sculpture, and a few circlers, standing between her and the piece, stepped out of the way.
No, no, it's good, May said. You guys help show the scale of it. Stay there, she said.
And they stepped back toward the object, which dwarfed them. The sculpture was 14 feet high, made of a thin and perfectly translucent form of plexiglass.
Though most of the artist's previous work had been conceptual, this was representational, unmistakable. A massive hand, as big as a car, was reaching out from, or through, a large rectangle, which most took to imply some sort of computer screen. The title of the piece was Reaching Through for the Good of Humankind, and had been noted, immediately upon its introduction, for its earnestness, anomalous to the artist's typical work, which had a darkly sardonic tone, usually at the expense of rising China and its attendant sense of self-worth.
This sculpture is really hitting the circlers at their core, May said. I've been hearing about people weeping before it. As you can see, people like to take photos.
May had seen circlers posing before the giant hand, as if it were reaching for them, about to take them, elevate them. May decided to interview the two people who were standing near the sculpture's outstretched fingers.
And you are?
Gino. I work in the machine age.
And what does this sculpture mean to you?
Well, I'm not an art expert, but I think it's pretty obvious. He's trying to say that we need more ways to reach through the screen, right?
May was nodding because this was the clear meaning for everyone on campus, but she felt it might as well be said, on camera, for anyone less adept at art interpretation. Efforts to contact the artist after its installation had been unsuccessful. Bailey, who had commissioned the work, said he had no hand.
You know me in puns, he said,
in its theme or execution. But he was thrilled with the result, and dearly wanted the artist to come to the campus to talk about the sculpture. But the artist had said he was unable to come in person, or even to teleconference. He'd rather let the sculpture speak for itself, he said. May turned to the woman with him.
Who are you?
Inku? Also from the machine age.
Do you agree with Gino?
I do. I mean, this feels very soulful to me, like, and how we need to find more ways to connect. The screen here is a barrier, and the hand is transcending it.
May was nodding, thinking she needed to wrap this up, when she saw, through the translucent wrist of the giant hand, someone who looked like Annie. It was a young woman, blonde, about Annie's height and build, and she was walking briskly across the quad. Rinku was still talking, having warmed up.
I mean, how can the circle find a way to make the connection between us and our users stronger? To me, it's incredible that this artist, so far away and from such a different world, expressed what was on the minds of all of us here at the circle. How to do better? Do more? Reach further, you know? How do we throw our hands through the screen to get closer to the world and everyone in it?
May was watching the Annie-like figure walk into the Industrial Revolution. When the door closed and Annie, or Annie's twin, disappeared within, May smiled at Rinku, thanked her and Gino, and checked the time. It was 1:49. She had to be with Dr. Villalobos in 11 minutes.
Annie!
The figure continued to walk. May was torn between really yelling, which typically upset the viewers, or running after Annie, which would cause the camera to shake violently, which also upset the viewers. She settled in a kind of speed walking while holding the camera against her chest. Annie turned another corner and then was gone. May heard the click of a door, the door to a stairway, and rushed to it. If she didn't know better, she would have thought Annie was avoiding her. When May entered the stairway, she looked up, saw Annie's distinctive hand, and yelled up, Annie! Now the figure stopped. It was Annie. She turned, slowly made her way down the steps, and when she saw May, she smiled a practiced, exhausted smile. They hugged, May knowing any embrace always provided for her viewers a semi-comical and occasionally mildly erotic moment, as the other hugger's body swooped toward and eventually subsumed the camera's lens. Annie pulled back, looked down at the camera, stuck out her tongue, and looked up at May.
Everyone? May said. This is Annie. You've heard about her, Gang of 40 member, World Strider, Beautiful Colossus, and my close personal friend. Say hi, Annie.
Hi,
Annie said.
So how was the trip?
May asked. Annie smiled, though May could tell through the briefest of grimaces that Annie was not enjoying this. But she conjured a happy mask and put it on.
It was great,
she said.
Anything you'd like to share? How did things go with everyone in Geneva?
Annie's smile wilted.
Oh, you know, we shouldn't talk about much of that stuff, given so much of it is
May nodded, assuring Annie she knew.
I'm sorry, I was just talking about Geneva as a location. Nice?
Sure, Annie said.
Just great. I saw the Von Trapps and they've gotten some new clothes, also made of drapes.
May glanced at her wrist. She had 9 minutes until she had to see Dr. Villalobos.
Anything else you'd like to talk about?
She asked.
What else?
Annie said.
Well, let me think.
Annie tilted her head, as if surprised and mildly annoyed that this faux visit was still continuing. But then something came over her, as if finally settling into what was happening, that she was stuck on camera and had to assume her mantle as company spokesperson.
Okay, there's another very cool program that we've been hinting at for a while, a system called Past Perfect, and in Germany I was working out some last hurdles to help it happen. We're currently looking for the right volunteer here within the Circle to try it out, but when we find the right person, it'll mean the start of a very new era for the Circle, and not to be overly dramatic about it, for humankind.
Not dramatic at all, May said.
Can you say anything more about it?
Sure, May. Thank you for asking, Annie said, looking briefly at her shoes before raising her eyes back to May with a professional smile.
I can say that the basic idea is to take the power of the Circle community and to map not just the present, but the past, too. We're right now digitizing every photo, every newsreel, every amateur video in every archive in this country and Europe. I mean, we're doing our best, at least. The task is Herculean, but once we have a critical mass and with facial recognition advances, we can, we hope, identify pretty much everyone in every photo and every video. You want to find every picture of your great-grandparents? We can make the archive searchable, and you can, we expect, we bet, then gain a greater understanding of them. Maybe you catch them in a crowd at the 1912 World's Fair. Maybe you find a video of your parents at a baseball game in 1974. The hope, in the end, is to fill in your memory and the historical record. And with the help of DNA and far better genealogical software, within the year, we're hoping that anyone can quickly access every available piece of information about their family lineage. All images, all video and film, with one search request.
And I imagine that when everyone else joins in, the Circle participants, that is, the gaps will quickly be filled. May smiled, her eyes telling Annie she was doing great.
That's right, May,
Annie said, her voice stabbing at the space between them. Like any project online, most of the completion will be done by the digital community. We're gathering our own millions of photos and videos, but the rest of the world will provide billions more. We expect that with even partial participation, we'll be able to fill in most historical holes easily. If you're looking for all the residents of a certain building in Poland, circa 1913, and you're missing one, it won't take long to triangulate that last person by cross-referencing from all the other data we'll get.
Very exciting.
Yes, it is, Annie said, and flashed the whites of her eyes, urging May to wrap all this up.
But you don't have the guinea pig yet?
May asked.
Not yet. For the first person, we're looking for someone whose family goes back pretty far in the United States, just because we'll know we'll have more complete access to records here than in some other countries.
And this is part of the Circle's plan to complete everything this year? It's still on schedule?
It is. Past Perfect is just about ready to use now, and with all the other aspects of completion, it looks like the beginning of next year. 8 months, and we'll be done. But you never know. The way things are going, with the help of so many Circlers out there, we could finish ahead of time.
May smiled, nodded, and she and Annie shared a long, strained moment when Annie's eyes again asked how long they needed to go on with this semi-performative dialogue. Outside, the sun broke through the clouds, and the light through the window shone down on Annie's face. May saw then, for the first time, how old she looked. Her face was drawn, her skin pale. Annie was not yet 27, but there were bags under her eyes. In this light, she seemed to have aged 5 years in the last 2 months. Annie took May's hand and dug her fingernails into her palm just enough to get her attention.
I actually have to use the bathroom. Come with?
Sure, I have to go too. Though May's transparency was complete, in that she could not turn off the visual or audio feeds at any time, there were a few exceptions, insisted upon by Bailey. One was during bathroom usage, or at least time spent on the toilet.
The video feed was to remain on because, Bailey insisted, the camera would be trained on the back of the stall door, so it hardly mattered. But the audio would be turned off, sparing May and the audience the sounds. May entered the stall. Annie entered the one next door. And May deactivated her audio. The rule was that she had up to 3 minutes of silence. More than that would provoke concern from viewers and circlers alike.
"So how are you?" May asked. She couldn't see Annie, but her toes, looking crooked and in need of a pedicure attention, were visible under the door.
"Great. Great. You?"
"Good."
"Well, you should be good," Annie said. "You are killing it."
"You think?"
"Come on, false modesty won't work here. You should be psyched."
"Okay, I am."
"I mean, you're like a meteor here. It's insane. People are coming to me trying to get to you. It's just so crazy."
Something had crept into Annie's voice that May recognized as envy, or its close cousin. May ran through a string of possibilities of what she could say in response. Nothing was right. "I couldn't have done it without you" would not work. It sounded both self-aggrandizing and condescending. In the end, she chose to change the subject.
"Sorry about asking stupid questions back there," May said.
"It's okay, but you put me on the spot."
"I know, I saw you and wanted to spend time with you, and I didn't know what else to ask about, so are you really okay? You look wiped out."
"Thank you, May. You know how much I like to be told seconds after I appear in front of your millions that I look terrible. Thank you. You're sweet."
"I'm just worried. Have you been sleeping?"
"I don't know. Maybe I'm off schedule. I'm jet-lagged."
"Is there anything I can do? Let me take you out to eat."
"Take me out to eat? With your camera and me looking so terrible? That sounds fantastic, but no."
"Let me do something for you."
"No, no. I just need to get caught up."
"Anything interesting?"
"Oh, you know, the usual."
"The regulatory stuff went well. They were really putting a lot on you out there. I worried."
A chill swept through Annie's voice.
"Well, you had no reason to worry. I've been doing this for a while now."
"I didn't mean I was worried in that way."
"Well, don't worry in any way."
"I know you can handle it."
"Thank you! May your confidence in me will be the wind beneath my wings."
May chose to ignore the sarcasm.
"So when do I get to see you?"
"Soon. We'll make something happen."
"Tonight? Please?"
"Not tonight. I'm just going to crash and get fresh for tomorrow. I have a bunch of stuff. There's all the new work on completion and completing the circle."
There was a long pause, during which May was sure that Annie was relishing this piece of news, unknown to May.
"Yeah, Bailey didn't tell you?"
Annie said. A certain exasperating music had entered her voice.
"I don't know," May said, her heart burning. "Maybe he did."
"Well, they're feeling very close now. I was out there removing some of the last barriers. The wise men think we're down to the last few hurdles."
"Oh, I think I might have heard that,"
May said, hearing herself, hearing how petty she sounded. But she was jealous. Of course she was. Why would she have access to information that Annie did? She knew she had no right to it, but still, she wanted it and felt she was closer to it than this, than hearing about it from Annie, who had been halfway around the world for 3 weeks. The omission threw her back to some ignominious spot at the circle, some plebeian place of being a spokeswoman, a public shill.
"So, you're sure I can't do anything for you? Maybe some kind of mud pack to help with the puffiness under your eyes?"
May hated herself for saying it, but it felt so good in that moment, like an itch scratched hard. Annie cleared her throat.
"You're so kind," she said. "But I should get going."
"You sure?"
"May, I don't want this to sound rude, but the best thing for me right now is to get back to my desk so I can get back to work."
"Okay."
"I'm not saying that in a rude way. I actually just need to get caught up."
"No, I know. I get it. That's fine. I'll see you tomorrow anyway. At the Concept Kingdom meeting?"
"What?"
"There's a Concept King...
No, I know what it is. You're going?"
"I am. Bailey thought I should go."
"And broadcast it?"
"Of course. Is that a problem?"
No, no,
Annie said, clearly stalling,
processing. I'm just surprised. Those meetings are full of sensitive intellectual property. Maybe he's planning to have you attend the beginning or something. I can't imagine.
Annie's toilet flushed, and May saw that she'd stood up.
You leaving?
Yeah, I'm really so late I want to puke now.
Okay, don't puke. Annie hurried to the door and was gone.
May had 4 minutes to get to Dr. Villalobos.
She stood, turned her audio back on, and left the bathroom. Then she walked back in, silenced her audio, sat down in the same stall, and gave herself a minute to get herself together. Let people think she was constipated. She didn't care. She was sure Annie was crying by now, wherever she was. May was sobbing and was cursing Annie, cursing every blonde inch of her smug sense of entitlement. So what that she'd been at the Circle longer? They were peers now, but Annie couldn't accept it. May would have to make sure she did.
It was 2:02 when she arrived. "Hello, May," Dr. Villalobos said, greeting her in the clinic lobby. "I see your heart rate is normal, and I imagine with your jog over here, all your viewers are getting some interesting data, too. Come in."
In retrospect, it shouldn't have been a surprise that Dr. Villalobos had become a viewer's favorite, too. With her extravagant curves, her sultry eyes, and harmonica voice, she was volcanic on screen. She was the doctor everyone, especially straight men, wished they'd had. Though True You had made lewd comments almost impossible for anyone wanting to keep their job or spouse, Dr. Villalobos brought out a genteel but no less demonstrative brand of appreciation.
"So good to see the good doctor,"
one man wrote as May entered the office.
"Let the examination begin," said another braver soul.
And Dr. Villalobos, while putting on a show of brisk professionalism, seemed to enjoy it, too. Today she was wearing a zippered blouse that displayed an amount of her ample chest that at a proper distance was appropriate, but, seen through May's close camera, was somehow obscene.
"So your vitals have been looking good," she said to May.
May was sitting on the examination table, the doctor standing before her. Looking at her wrist, May checked the image her viewers were getting, and she knew the men would be pleased. As if realizing the picture might be getting too provocative, Dr. Villalobos turned to the wall screen. On it, a few hundred data points were displayed.
"Your step count could be better," she said. "You're averaging only 5,300 when you should be at 10,000. Someone your age, especially, should be even higher than that."
"I know," May said. "It's just been busy lately."
"Okay, but let's bring those steps up. As a promise to me? Now, because we're talking to all your watchers now, I'd like to tout the overall program your own data feeds into, May. It's called the Complete Health Data Program, or CHAD for short. Chad was an ex of mine, and Chad, if you're out there, I didn't name it for you."
May's wrist went wild with messages. "Chad, you fool."
"Through CHAD, we get real-time data on everyone at the Circle. May, you and the newbies were the first to get the new wristbands, but since then, we've equipped everyone else at the Circle. And this has enabled us to get perfect and complete data on the 11,000 people here. Can you imagine? The first boon has been that when the flu arrived on campus last week, we knew in minutes who brought it. We sent her home, and no one else was infected. If only we could prevent people from bringing germs onto campus, right? If they never left, getting dirty out there, then we'd be all set. But let me get off my soapbox and focus on you, May."
"As long as the news is good," May said, and tried to smile. But she was uneasy and wanted to move all this along.
"Well, I think it's good," the doctor said. "This comes from a watcher in Scotland. He'd been tracking your vitals and cross-referencing with your DNA markers. He realized that the way you're eating, particularly nitrates, is elevating your propensity for cancer."
"Jesus, really? Is that the bad news I'm here for?"
"No, no. Don't worry. It's easily solved. You don't have cancer and probably won't get it. But you know you have a marker for gastrointestinal cancer, just an increased risk, and this researcher in Glasgow who'd been following you and your vitals saw that you're eating salami and other meats with nitrates that might be tipping you towards cellular mutation."
"You keep scaring me."
"Oh, God, I'm sorry. I don't mean to. But thank God he was watching. I mean, we're watching, too, and we're getting better at watching all the time, but the beauty of having so many friends out there, as you do, is that one of them, 5,000 miles away, has helped you avert a growing risk.
So no more nitrates.
Right. Let's keep the nitrates.
I've zinged you a list of foods that contain them, and your watchers can see too. They should always be eaten in moderation, but should be avoided altogether if there's any history of or risk of cancer. I hope you'll be sure to convey this to your parents, in case they haven't been checking their own zing feed.
Oh, I'm sure they have, May said.
Okay, and this is the not-so-good news. It's not about you or your health. It's your parents. They're fine, but I want to show you something.
The doctor brought up the sea-change camera feeds in May's parents' house, set up a month into her father's treatment. The medical team at the Circle was taking a strong interest in her father's case and wanted as much data as it could get.
You see anything wrong?
May scanned the screen. Where a grid of 16 images should have been visible, 12 were blank.
There are only 4 working, she said.
Correct, said the doctor.
May watched the 4 feeds for signs of her parents. She saw none.
Has Tech been there to check?
No need.
We saw them do it. For each one, they reached up and put some kind of cover over them, maybe just some sticker or fabric. Did you know about these?
I didn't. I'm so sorry. They shouldn't have done this.
Instinctively, May checked her current viewership. 1,298,001. It always spiked during the visits to Dr. Villalobos. Now all these people knew. May felt her face flush.
Have you heard from your folks recently?
Dr. Villalobos asked.
Our records say you haven't, but maybe not in the last few days, May said.
In fact, she hadn't been in touch for over a week. She tried to call them, to no avail. She'd zinged and received no response.
Would you be willing to go visit?
The doctor asked.
As you know, good medical care is hard to provide when we're in the dark.
May was driving home, having left work at 5, something she hadn't done in weeks, and was thinking of her parents, what kind of madness had overtaken them, and she was worried that somehow Mercer's own madness had infected them. How dare they disconnect cameras? After all she'd done to help, after all the Circle had done to bend all rules to come to their aid, and what would Annie say?
Damn her,
May thought as she made her way home, the air growing warmer as the distance grew between her and the Pacific. May had set up her lens on the car dash, inserting it into a special mount created for her time in the car.
That fucking debutante.
This was bad timing. Annie would likely find some way to turn all this to her advantage, just when her envy of May, and it was that, it was so abundantly obvious, was growing. She could cut May down to size again. May and her nothing town, her parking garage parents who couldn't keep their screens operational, who couldn't keep themselves healthy, who took a monumental gift, premium health care, for free, and abused it. May knew what Annie was thinking in her little entitled blonde head. You just can't help some people. Annie's family line went back to the Mayflower, her ancestors having settled this country, and their ancestors having owned some vast swath of England. Their blood was blue all the way back, it seemed, to the invention of the wheel. In fact, if anyone's bloodline had invented the wheel, it would have been Annie's. It would make absolute and perfect sense and would surprise no one. May had discovered all this one Thanksgiving at Annie's house, with 20-odd relatives there, all with their thin noses, their pink skin, their weak eyes hidden behind 40 lenses, when she became aware, during an appropriately self-effacing conversation, for Annie's family was equally unwilling to talk too much or care too much about their lineage, that some distant relative of theirs had been at the very first Thanksgiving.
Oh, God, who cares?
Annie's mother had said, when May had pressed for more details.
Some random guy got on a boat. He probably owed money all over the old country.
And they had proceeded with dinner. Afterward, Annie had, at May's insistence, shown her some documents, ancient yellowed papers detailing their family history, a beautiful black portfolio of genealogies, scholarly articles, pictures of grave old men with extravagant sideburns standing near rough-hewn cabins. In other visits to Annie's house, her family was equally generous, unassuming and careless with their name. But when Annie's sister was married and the extended family arrived, May saw a different side. She was seated at a table of single men and women, most of them Annie's cousins, and next to Annie's aunt. She was a wiry woman in her 40s, her features similar to Annie's but arranged with lesser results. She was recently divorced, having left a man
beneath my station,
she said with pretend haughtiness. And do you know Annie from? She'd first turned to May fully 20 minutes into dinner. College, we were roommates. I thought her roommate was Pakistani. That was freshman year. And you saved the day. Where are you from? Middle of the state? Central Valley? A small town no one's heard of? Sort of near Fresno? May drove on, remembering all this, some of it injecting fresh pain into her, something still wet and raw. Wow, Fresno, the aunt had said, pretending to smile. I haven't heard that word in a long time, thank God. She'd taken a swallow from her gin and tonic and squinted out at the wedding party. The important thing is that you got out. I know good colleges look for people like you. That's probably why I didn't get in where I wanted to. Don't let anyone tell you Exeter helps. So many quota spots to fill with people from Pakistan and Fresno, right? The first time she'd gone home transparent had been revelatory and had burnished May's faith in humanity. She'd had a simple evening with her parents, making and eating dinner, and while doing so, they discussed the differences in her father's treatment before and after they became insured through the circle. Viewers could see both the triumphs of his treatment. Her father seemed vibrant and moved with ease through the house. But they also saw the toll the disease was taking on him. He fell awkwardly while trying to make his way upstairs, and afterward there was a flood of messages from concerned viewers, followed by thousands of smiles from all over the world. People suggesting new drug combinations, new physical therapy regimens, new doctors, experimental treatments, Eastern medicine, Jesus. Hundreds of churches put him in their weekly prayers. May's parents felt confident in their doctors, and most viewers could see that her father's care was exceptional. So what was more important and plentiful than the medical comments were those simply cheering him and the family on. May cried reading the messages. It was a flood of love. People sharing their own stories, so many living with MS themselves. Others spoke of their own struggles, living with osteoporosis, with Bell's palsy, with Crohn's disease. May had been forwarding the messages to her parents, but after a few days decided to make their own email and mailing address public so her parents could be emboldened and inspired by the outpouring themselves every day. This, the second time she'd gone home, would, she knew, be even better. After she addressed the issue with the cameras, which she expected was some sort of misunderstanding, she planned to give all those who had reached out the chance to see her parents again, and to give her parents a chance to thank all those who had sent them smiles and help. She found the two of them in the kitchen, chopping vegetables. "How are you guys?" she said, while forcing them into a three-way embrace. They both smelled of onions.
"You're sure affectionate tonight, May," her father said.
"Ha-ha," May said, and tried to indicate with the rolling back of her eyelids that they should not imply that she was ever less affectionate. As if remembering that they were on camera and that their daughter was now a more visible and important person, her parents adjusted their behavior. They made lasagna, with May adding a few ingredients additional guidance had asked her to bring and display to watchers. When dinner was ready and May had given adequate camera time to the products, they all sat down.
"So there's a slight concern from the health folks that some of your cameras aren't working," May said, keeping it light.
"Really?"
her father said, smiling.
"Maybe we should check the batteries."
He winked at her mother.
"You guys," May said,
knowing she had to make this statement very clear, knowing this was a pivotal moment for their own health and the overall health data gathering system the Circle was trying to make possible.
"How can anyone provide you with good health care when you don't allow them to see how you're doing? It's like going to see a doctor and not allowing her to take your pulse."
"That's a very good point," her father said. "I think we should eat."
"We'll get them fixed right away," her mother said,
and that began what was a very strange night, during which May's parents agreed readily with all of May's arguments about transparency, nodded their heads vigorously when she talked about the necessity for everyone to be on board, the corollary to vaccines, how they only worked with full participation. They agreed heartily with it all, complimenting May repeatedly on her powers of persuasion and logic. It was odd. They were being far too cooperative. They sat down to eat, and May did something she'd never done before. and which she hoped her parents wouldn't ruin by acting like it was unusual. She gave a toast.
"Here's a toast to you two," she said. "And while we're at it, a toast to all the thousands of people who reached out to you guys after the last time I was here."
Her parents smiled stiffly and raised their glasses. They ate for a few moments, and when her mother had carefully chewed and swallowed her first bite, she smiled and looked directly into the lens, which May had told her repeatedly not to do.
"Well, we sure did get a lot of messages," her mother said.
May's father joined in.
"Your mom's been sorting through 'em, and we've been making a little dent in the pile every day, but it's a lot of work, I have to say."
Her mother rested her hand on May's arm.
"Not that we don't appreciate it, because we do. We surely do. I just want to go on record as asking everyone's forgiveness for our tardiness in answering all the messages."
"We've gotten thousands,"
her father noted, poking at his salad. Her mother smiled stiffly.
"And again, we appreciate the outpouring, but even if we spent 1 minute on each response, that's 1,000 minutes. Think of it, 16 hours just for some basic response to the messages. Oh, geez, now I sound ungrateful."
May was glad her mother said this, because they did sound ungrateful. They were complaining about people caring about them, and just when May thought her mother would reverse herself, would encourage more good wishes, her father spoke and made it worse. Like her mother, he spoke directly into the lens.
"But we do ask you, from now on, to just send your best wishes through the air. Or if you pray, just pray for us. No need to put it into a message, just..."
And he closed his eyes and squeezed them tight.
"Send your good wishes, your good vibes, our way. No need to email or zing or anything. Just good thoughts. Send them through the air. That's all we ask."
"I think you just mean to say," May said, trying to hold her temper, "that it'll just take you a little while to answer all of the messages, but you'll get to them all eventually."
Her father didn't hesitate.
"Well, I can't say that, May. I don't want to promise that. It's actually very stressful, and we've already had many people get angry when they don't hear back from us in a given amount of time. They send one message, then they send 10 more in the same day. Did I say something wrong? Sorry, I was only trying to help. Up yours. They have these neurotic conversations with themselves, so I don't want to imply the kind of immediate message turnaround that most of your friends seem to require."
"Dad, stop. You sound terrible."
Her mother leaned forward.
"May, your dad's just trying to say that our lives are already pretty fraught, and we have our hands full just working, paying bills, and taking care of the health stuff. If we have 16 hours more work to do, then that puts us in an untenable position. Can you see where we're coming from? I say that again with all due respect and gratitude to everyone who has wished us well."
After dinner, her parents wanted to watch a movie, and they did so. Basic Instinct, at her father's insistence. He'd seen it more than any other film, always citing the nods to Hitchcock, the many witty homage. Though he'd never made clear his love of Hitchcock in the first place, May had long suspected that the movie, with its constant and varied sexual tensions, made him randy. As her parents watched the film, May tried to make the time more interesting by sending a series of zings about it, tracking and commenting on the number of moments offensive to the LGBT community. She was getting a great response, but then saw the time, 9:30, and figured she should get on the road and back to the circle.
"Well, I'm going to head out," she said.
May thought she caught something in her father's eye, some quick look to her mother that might have said, "At last," but she could have been mistaken. She put on her coat, and her mother met her at the door, an envelope in her hand.
"Mercer asked us to give this to you."
May took it, a simple business-sized envelope. It wasn't even addressed to her. No name, nothing. She kissed her mother's cheek, left the house, the air outside still warm. She pulled out and drove toward the highway. But the letter was on her lap, and her curiosity overtook her. She pulled over and opened it.
"Dear May, yes, you can and should read this on camera. I expected that you would, so I'm writing this letter not only to you, but to your audience. Hello, audience."
She could almost hear his introductory intake of breath, his settling in before an important speech.
I can't see you anymore, May. Not that we had such a constant or perfect friendship anyway, but I can't be your friend and also part of your experiment. I'll be sad to lose you, as you have been important in my life, but we've taken very different evolutionary paths, and very soon we'll be too far apart to communicate. If you saw your parents and your mom gave you this note, then you saw the effect all your stuff has had on them. I wrote this note after seeing them, both of them, strung out, exhausted by the deluge you unleashed on them. It's too much, May, and it's not right. I helped them cover some of the cameras. I even bought the fabric. I was happy to do it. They don't want to be smiled upon, or frowned upon, or zinged. They want to be alone, and not watched. Surveillance shouldn't be the trade-off for any goddamn service we get. If things continue this way, there will be two societies, or at least I hope there will be two. The one you're helping create, and an alternative to it. You and your ilk will live willingly, joyfully, under constant surveillance, watching each other always, commenting on each other, voting and liking and disliking each other, smiling and frowning, and otherwise doing nothing much else. Already there were comments pouring through her wrist. May, were you ever so young and dumb? How did you end up dating a zero like this? That was the most popular, soon superseded by, just looked up his picture. Does he have some Sasquatch somewhere in the family tree? She continued reading the letter. I will always wish all good things for you, May. I also hope, though I realize how unlikely it is, that somewhere down the line, when the triumphalism of you and your peers, the unrestrained manifest destiny of it all, goes too far and collapses into itself, that you'll regain your sense of perspective and your humanity. Hell, what am I saying? It's already gone too far. What I should say is that I await the day when some vocal minority finally rises up to say it's gone too far, and that this tool, which is far more insidious than any human invention that's come before it, must be checked, regulated, turned back, and that most of all, we need options for opting out. We're living in a tyrannical state now, where we are not allowed to... May checked how many pages were left. 4 more double-sided sheets, likely containing more of the same directionless blather. She threw the pile in the passenger seat. Poor Mercer. He'd always been a blowhard, and he never knew his audience. And though she knew he was using her parents against her, something was bothering her. Were they really that annoyed? She was only a block away, so she got out and walked back home. If they were truly upset, well, she would and could address it. When she walked in, she didn't see them in the two most likely places, the living room and the kitchen, and peeked around the corner into the dining room. They were nowhere. The only sign of them at all was a pot of water boiling on the stove. She tried not to panic, but that pot of boiling water and the otherwise eerie quiet of the house arranged itself in a crooked way in her mind, and very suddenly she was thinking of robberies, or suicide pacts, or kidnappings. She ran up the stairs, taking them 3 at a time, and when she reached the top and turned left quickly into their bedroom, she saw them, their eyes turned to her, round and terrified. Her father was sitting on the bed, and her mother was kneeling on the floor, his penis in her hand. A small container of moisturizer rested against his leg. In an instant, they all knew the ramifications. May turned away, directing the camera toward a dresser. No one said a word. May could think only of retreating to the bathroom, where she pointed the camera at the wall and turned off the audio. She rewound her spool to see what had been caught on camera. She hoped the lens swinging from her neck had somehow missed the effect.